Good evening, bonsoir, madame et messieurs. Je voudrais me présenter. Je suis Hugo Melgar Quiñones, directeur du McGill Institute pour la sécurité alimentaire mondiale. Bienvenue à la 7e conférence McGill sur la sécurité alimentaire mondiale. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Hugo Melgar Quiñones. I am the director of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. And I welcome you all to the 7th McGill Conference on Global Food Security. The theme of this year's conference is Food Security Beyond 2015. You will have the opportunity in the next 2 days to be part of the unveiling of a new era in which improved nutritional status of global populations is driven by agriculture and other disciplines as their raison d'etre. We are very honored this year to have speakers and guests from many different countries, distinguished participants coming from other cities, other universities in Canada, in the United States, in Burkina Faso, in Ghana, in Guatemala, Nigeria, colleagues coming to visit us, to share with us their thoughts, their reflections, their knowledge from Italy, from Switzerland. There are probably other countries I haven't mentioned, but this is a place where for the 7th time, for the 7th year in a row, we gather to share, to discuss, and to learn. I would like to welcome all of you to this room. There are some people who, for the first time, visit us in these conferences. Others have been here year by year joining us, and we are very thankful for that. I would like to thank the sponsors and donors who support the Global Food Security Conference, who have been supporting this conference for several years. Your support is essential. It's a fundamental help to us to continue bringing this audience and the speakers and participants to this type of events. In particular, I would like to thank the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, and we welcome Mr. Postcastle from the Switzerland office in this conference, as well as Laurie Goodwin and Chris Davison from Syngenta Canada. Thank you very much for your support. I would also like to thank the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization for their assistance in supporting the travel of one of our speakers for tomorrow, one of our keynote speakers, Dr. Carlo Cafiero. My thanks to all donors who sponsor student tickets, student passes. Many of us in this room are here, perhaps for the first time in their training careers, in their learning process, thanks to your support. Thank you so much to Mrs. Erin Hogg for sponsoring our student poster session as well. Thank you, Erin. We are very grateful to different partners, certainly the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at McGill, in the Mac campus, my colleagues, the staff working in the faculty, our students. We thank the Continuing Professional Development Office at the Mac campus. We are thankful to the McDonald's Tour Foundation for their support, as well as to Roland Greenbank. Thank you to you as our audience in this conference. We are very pleased that you are joining us this year and welcome you all. I would like to officially open the 2014 Conference in Global Food Security at McGill University. Today and tomorrow, we'll be hearing, and some of you will be sharing your work in many different countries. I have a list of at least 12 countries that will be part of the discussions at this podium in our sessions. So I hope you enjoy those sessions as much as I have done before at this type of conferences at McGill. In addition to our four sessions tomorrow, which will be greatly highlighting the research of our colleagues in the Mac campus and in other institutions, academic institutions, we'll be hearing from Dean Chandra Madramutu. He's the Dean of the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences, and he is the founding chair of the Global Food Security Conferences. He will deliver the feature address tomorrow towards food security, breaking the barriers of food production. In the afternoon, Dr. Carlo Caffiero, who's a senior statistician at the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, will deliver the afternoon keynote address, Voices of the Hungry, and the Post-2015 Agenda. By the end of the day tomorrow, Mr. Dr. Renaud Deplan, program leader at the International Development Research Center, IDRC, will deliver the conference wrap-up. Thank you so much for that support, Renaud. We are honored tonight to have among us Mr. Stephen McCurk, who is an acting vice president, program and partnership in branch at the International Development Research Center. He will present tonight the public lecture keynote address, Agriculture Means Business, an African Narrative. We are very much looking forward to Steve McGurk's lecture. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. With that said, I would like to introduce now Dean Chandra Madramutu, who I mentioned before is Dean in our Agriculture and Environmental Sciences faculty, founded these conferences, was launching this annual Global Food Security Conferences starting in 2008, and was also launching the McGill Institute for Global Food Security in 2010. Please join me in welcoming Dean Chandra Madramutu.
Thank you very much, Hugo. Merci beaucoup. Et bonsoir tout le monde. C'est un plaisir pour moi de dire quelques mots, des introductions de Dr. Steve McGurk, le vice-président de IDRC. A trained economist and sinologist, Stephen McGurk has spent more than three decades studying Asia's rural development. Prior to acting as vice president of the Program and Partnerships Branch of IDRC, Dr. McGurk was the director of IDRC's Agriculture and Environment Program, a program that is dedicated to supporting research that seeks to increase agricultural productivity as well as food and water security while ensuring environmental sustainability. Previously, Stephen served as the IDRC Regional Director in IDRC's South Asia and China office, located in Delhi, and in the Southeast and Asia office in Singapore. Dr. McGurk has worked with the Ford Foundation in Beijing, where he was responsible for its economic security program in China. Il a enseigné à l'Université de Californie et il a travaillé aussi avec la Banque mondiale sur les politiques des générations d'investissements dans le secteur de développement rural en Chine. Dr. McGurk holds a PhD from Stanford University's Food Research Institute, and I've had the great pleasure to interact with Dr. McGurk on many an occasion in various fora that were convened by former Minister Fantino and also the President of IDRC. And had a pleasure to collaborate with him on several initiatives. And Stephen, we look forward to your presentation tonight. Welcome on behalf of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, on behalf of McGill University. We thank you for taking the time from an enormously busy schedule to be with us. Thank you so much.
Bonsoir à tous et à toutes. C'est un grand plaisir pour moi, mais c'est très intimidant de parler de sécurité alimentaire devant un auditoire si influential comme celle-ci. Aussi parce que je ne sois pas expert dans le domaine de sécurité alimentaire Afrique subsaharienne. My father was a graduate of McGill. My mother was a graduate of McGill. I have two brothers who are graduates of McGill, and my wife got a degree at McGill. I was the black sheep. Most of the degrees of most of my family at McGill were in the sciences and in engineering. My first degree was in Chinese and on the West Coast. You can understand how my family looked with scorn at what I chose to do with my life. So it's a great irony to actually be addressing any kind of scholarly audience at McGill. I feel like you should run me out of town, particularly because the subject I've chosen to talk to you about, while I have some reason for talking about it, is not a domain in which I am in any way an expert. And frankly, there are many more of you here who are far more expert in this than I. So while it's a pleasure, Chandra, it's also extremely intimidating. So, why am I doing it? You might ask. Couple of reasons. In the last 15 years, I've increasingly seen things happening in Africa, particularly, I would say, in the last 8 years in sub-Saharan Africa that are strikingly reminiscent of things that have been happening in Asia over the last 15 years. Obviously, there are major differences as well, but it's striking some of the similarities. And so that's really what I want to talk about. I'll phrase it in terms of a debate that's going on now around Afro-optimism. I'll talk about where the opportunities really might be. And then I will talk from the perspective of a grant maker supporting research in sub-Saharan countries and in Canada and elsewhere on the problems of food security in sub-Saharan Africa with some practical examples. So most recently, the Minister of Agriculture of Nigeria, Akinwumi Adesina, decried how the world sees Africa and particularly agriculture in Africa as a social sector. This is the cover of Time magazine, August 2008, not 1983, but 2008. And so here's the traditional paradigm. So traditional farming, you walk 50 meters outside the house of an African a farmstead, and the luxuriant maize disintegrates into dry, scraggly maize and even more dried out beans, and there's really not much else. So traditional farming, few external inputs, little output is actually sold. Traders exploit farmers, get them tied up in extractive relationships and in debt. Very wasteful in terms of post-harvest, so almost nothing is processed, so much is wasted. I'm reminding you, this is the traditional narrative, okay? I'm not saying this is the reality. This is the narrative. Farmers and markets are unable to differentiate quality, so there's no imperative to actually increase productivity. because you get nothing for your productivity. There's no grading, labeling, or branding of any farm products. Value chains are stagnant and perform poorly. There's almost no defense against natural disaster, and consumers overpay for food. Contrast that with what Minister Adesina discusses just this year at AGRA. Agriculture is business. So this is the same country, Ethiopia, the same year. In fact, just a month before that time cover. And this is one of 55 warehouses in 17 districts of Ethiopia that is part of the commodities exchange, which was established in 2008 in Ethiopia. So the new narrative says that agriculture is not a social sector. It's a business. Governments catalyze investments so that farmers can recognize premium for quality. So they put concrete floors in their wholesale market so that farmers can actually differentiate their grains when they bring them in. Farmers are entrepreneurs directly linked to these wholesale markets. Midstream processing, handling, and downstream retail are diverse, and they're directly linked to urban consumers. Input supply and food prices are declining, not increasing. In fact, that's the global pattern for the last 2 years. Stocks are back to pre-crisis levels. Prices are dropping. People don't have places to store crops. Talk to Prairie Province farmers here in Canada. They'll tell you. So how relevant would we say this new narrative, Minister Adesina's narrative? This is the Global Hunger Index for 2013. It is three equally weighted indicators: the proportion of people who are undernourished, the proportion of children younger than age 5 who are underweight, and the mortality rate of children younger than 5. It's color-coded, so you can see that sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia range from serious to extremely alarming in terms of this global hunger index. Minister Adesina, I'm sorry I'm picking on him, he's not here, but he would stick up for it and would give me lots of stick if he was here. So please allow me to take him as a stick figure for this discussion. He would say, in fact he has said, in the midterm review of the CGIAR, that Africa currently imports $30 to $50 billion a year in food. Slow growth in agricultural productivity in sub-Saharan Africa. The line at the bottom here in purple, if it comes out purple, is sub-Saharan Africa. This is from 1990 to 2010. This is USDA Economic Research Service numbers. This is cereal yields by region. So North Africa, Asia, Latin America, more or less parallel each other. Significant ag productivity growth and from a medium potential level. Sub-Saharan Africa, much lower levels and almost no growth. Only 6% of cultivated land in Africa is irrigated, although it produces 20% of agricultural value, that 6% of irrigated land. So clearly there's tremendous scope for post-harvest productivity. Here's a slight nuance to that story. So this may not be visible to you, it's barely visible to me, and I apologize. There's some question about the data since 2006. Most of the data on which these long-term trends in productivity have not picked up a lot of the data from 2006. It appears, while yields remain very low in sub-Saharan Africa, some countries have started to substantially change that from about 2006. And here I'm giving you three examples: South Africa, Ethiopia and Uganda. And a further example in Ethiopia, differentiated by crops. And in the last of these graphics, you can see that virtually every single crop grown in Ethiopia has experienced significant productivity growth in a very short period of time, starting about 2006. What's driving, if a change is happening, if there's lots of grounds for optimism, what's driving that? Well, it does seem to be one very large driver, and that's urban-linked food markets. Urban markets now form roughly 60% of all purchased and marketed foods in Africa. So these are major funders of flows of funds that go back to rural areas. Rural-urban supply chain actors form 50 to 70% of food price in urban market. So these rural to urban food supply chains, they become absolutely central to food security. These, remember, are all downstream of the farm. I'm not going to get into why urbanization is happening, but one of the things that's happening alongside urbanization in Africa, well, there's a number of interesting trends. One is that there has been income increases in urban areas and diet diversification as these incomes have increased. Another interesting trend has been that it's not just the prime cities of Latin America that have grown. It's also secondary cities. And in fact, the growth in urbanization in Africa is much more evenly balanced than it is in South Asia and Latin America. Thank you. So this appears to be a very significant driver of potential change. What I would like to point to, and unfortunately all I have is a little bit of anecdotal evidence cited by the Kofi Annan Foundation, is that what's underneath this pattern of linked rural to urban markets is millions of small and medium African entrepreneurs, not international ag business, not the Syngentas of the world. Processors, tiny retailers. Teff value chains in Ethiopia, wheat and maize, flour mills, and wholesale markets and transport small and medium enterprises in Ethiopia. Maize processors in Zambia and Zimbabwe. Fertilizer small and medium enterprises in Kenya. Sorghum beer brewing SMEs in southern Africa, dairy-related SMEs in Kenya and Zambia. There is absolutely dynamic growth in these midstream and downstream segments of these rural food chains, and what's driving them is increasing urban demand for increasingly diverse foods beyond basic cereals. Now, these SMEs are clearly the missing middle, if you permit a term from South Asia. They are the generators of employment. In fact, when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, unlike Latin America, unlike most of Asia outside of South Asia, there's almost no manufacturing in sub-Saharan Africa. Governments are swollen with people. So the only area where more jobs can be created is actually in agriculture. And it's in these dynamic areas where jobs are being created. Now, how much do they need to worry about international agribusiness? International ag business is increasingly aware of these opportunities in Africa's cities. They are moving to try to take advantage of these markets as their shareholders would want them to. How much should we worry about that? How much should that worry these small and medium African entrepreneurs involved in these food chains? Probably the answer for quite some time is not very much. Why? Currently, if you take Nestle, if you take all the fair trade, all the Unilever farmers that are part of the food chains for these major corporates in sub-Saharan Africa, and you multiply that number by four times current levels. So Nestle works with, I think, about 350,000 small farmers in Africa in their food chains. You multiply that number and every other international ag business and civil society initiative around fair trade by four. That number is less than 2% of all smallholder farmers in Africa. Multiplied by four, it's less than 2%. That's how little these markets are actually penetrated now by international ag business. So there's huge potential for growth by African small and medium entrepreneurs. Now, this is what Asia looked like 10 years ago. In South Asia, the food industry has grown, the modern food industry has grown 45% per year, every year for the last decade. 45% a year growth per a decade. This is transformative, and you'll see it all over South Asia. We're seeing the same starts to the same kinds of trends happening in sub-Saharan Africa. This is an enormous engine of transformation, I would maintain, and in fact, there's huge scope to do far more. Of course, these kinds of transformations are very uneven. If you're not linked into a large motor of growth in terms of an urban marketplace, then you will struggle. If you don't have access to good feeder roads to get your produce to wholesale markets, you will struggle. So clearly there's a need for policy differentiation, for governments to help these kinds of dynamic rural to urban food systems actually begin to reach out to the next nearest rural areas. There is a need to put in place the catalytic investments in research and development in seeds, in infrastructure, irrigation canals, railway systems, rural wholesale markets, power grids to allow for more processing, mobile phone communication grids, extension systems. The best extension system in Africa right now is in Ethiopia. And it's unbelievable to see how they have completely transformed their extension system from one that was almost completely moribund even a decade ago to one that is now the best in Africa, and it's making a big difference. Modernization of input supply chains and post-harvest logistics and wholesale, cold storage, milling, retailing, all of this is critically important, and this is where governments can help make a big difference. Can research help? I work for, as does it know, a research grant maker. I care about knowledge. I think knowledge can make a difference. Can it make a difference? There's a lot of skepticism. There's a sense that research projects take far too long to show results. They fail to benefit many poor people. Projects remain islands of success. There's major gaps in understanding how to get new technologies, tools, and innovations into the hands of the poor, and particularly into the hands of women, such that food security can come alongside improved nutrition and health in households. At least half of what is grown and produced is lost post-harvest. Is there something research can do about that? Well, there's key coordination challenges here. We don't know how innovations are actually taken up at scale. I was discussing with Miguel just before we began today about some of the work that's been done in the Andes around how to scale up local innovations into things that can be adapted in far greater areas. And frankly, this is more artifice than science. It seems clear that we need to get much better at explicitly modeling what is core to these local innovations and what is not, and what needs to, the knowledge embedded in these local innovations needs to be explicitly modeled so we can make sure in very different contexts with very different institutional setups that we're able to make best use of that embedded knowledge. Let me give you three quick examples and then I'll stop. So the food crisis of 2008 led the government of Canada to commit to doubling funding to sustainable agricultural development and to food security being a major plank of Canada's development assistance. Canada was not alone in this. Virtually all of the OECD countries made similar kinds of commitments, although actually very few have followed through on those, but that's another matter. So let me talk about one particular, and in fact it's the largest research part of this signal investment by Canadian International Assistance in food security. It's called the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund. The dots on the map represent all of the places where the many different partners who participate in this effort over the last 5 years, six of them are at McGill University. There's only one dot for McGill, and God knows I probably didn't put it in the right place on the map, but there you go. But it should be six dots on top of one dot. So this doesn't represent the totality. Let me just say that this is more than 140 practical innovations that have been developed and tested in 21 major projects. Each project is about $5 million, you know, in total, in 20 different countries. They've involved 97,000 poor farmers, of which 46,000 have been poor women farmers. Strategies for innovations to be deployed and on a large scale are the focus of our next 5 years of work. So currently, the six efforts underway here at McGill are themselves under the gun to see if they would qualify for further support for a major effort to scale out the innovations that they've developed and tested. I can't tell you the results of that, Chandra. Talk to Renaud. The triage is still underway. So I'm going to talk tonight about three specific examples of work from this initiative that combines cutting-edge field and laboratory science to improve agricultural productivity with business-oriented social sciences with a very strong gender focus to improve the productivity of midstream and downstream processing, handling, storage, and distribution. The first is of work across sub-Saharan Africa, so this is virtually the entire continent, on inexpensive livestock vaccines. It involves teams of researchers from the South African Agricultural Research Council, the Kenyan Agricultural Research Institute, VITO at the University of Saskatchewan, Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization, I think I got VITO right, and the founder or co-founder of VITO, who's now the Vice President of Research at the University of Alberta. The second example comes from southern Ethiopia, with the Ethiopian theme that I began with. Involves researchers from the University of Hawassa and the University of Saskatchewan to improve nutrition through plant breeding and soil management, and the last from Nigeria that involves researchers from two Canadian universities, University of Manitoba and the University of Cape Breton, to improve production, processing, and marketing of locally important vegetables. And just to be clear, I attended none of those schools. So, livestock vaccines. So reducing livestock losses is a key factor in the management of livestock, and it's a crucial economic asset for millions of people in Africa, Asia too, and it's a vital source of high-protein food, micronutrients, and agricultural inputs as well. So livestock produces over 30% of household incomes to small-scale mixed-crop livestock farmers, and over 50% of pastoralist incomes. At a global level, livestock systems have an estimated asset value of $1.4 trillion U.S. dollars, and they contribute fully 33% of agricultural GDP globally. Livestock diseases, we have almost no information on this. We've dug out the few things that we're able to tell you. Livestock diseases cause an estimated 17% loss in global production and perhaps as much as 25% of losses in production in sub-Saharan Africa. In Western Kenya, for example, a third of livestock die every year, mostly due to disease. In cattle, the cost of disease-related mortality was shown to be equivalent to be about 80% of the total value of livestock output in livestock-keeping households. You have to wonder why they keep livestock. They virtually lose their entire output every year due to disease. Animal losses due to lung plague in cows, what's called CBPP, contagious bovine pleuropneumonia, is estimated to exceed $1 billion annually. Economic losses due to East Coast fever, it's a tick that causes it. In 11 countries, it's about $300 million U.S. a year. So these numbers are just fantastic, hard to believe, but clearly on a gargantuan scale. So, what are we doing about this? Well, we have three different vaccines under development. They're all thermostable, which is to say they do not need refrigeration. So, they're safer to use. They are cheaper to use because they don't require cold chains. The first is on lung plague for cows. The second is African swine fever. And the third, and most interesting one in my view, is a 5-in-1 vaccine. And here it is, 5-in-1, multivalent vaccine development. So here you have five diseases and their incidence across the world. You'll see they're all African diseases except for two, sheep and goat pox, which have now dramatically expanded to all of Asia, with a slight exception, in southern Africa. Lumpy skin disease, which has now expanded into the Middle East. Rift Valley fever, which is not the entirety of Africa, but most of Africa, as well now as the Middle East. And the Peste Petit Ruminant, which has now spread very broadly across sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. So this is, think of a Lego set, and think of a Lego train, and think about adding in a vaccine for the train itself, this pox, let's call it a sheep pox Lego train, and then adding also a goat pox vaccine to that same sheep pox train, and then adding a lung plague, CBPP vaccine onto that same train. Think about that train having five different vaccines that you can give to your cow, to your sheep, to your goat, and potentially even to your pig, protecting all of your animals against a wide range of diseases, one shot, no refrigeration, cheap, easy to use. Wouldn't that be great? That's what we're doing, and we've tested this. There are some minor issues that we're working on for the next 5 years. For example, we can't do a 5-in-1 vaccine in Southern Africa because Southern African regulatory authorities won't permit introduction of diseases that are not in that region as part of a vaccine. So we have to do a 3-in-1 for Southern Africa, and so on. So there's sort of slicing and dicing that one can do with this. We're also in the midst of talking to both parastatals involved in vaccine delivery as well as pharmaceutical companies about vaccine delivery. This potentially is a game changer for the livestock industry worldwide. Let me talk about a second example. This is Hawassa, southern Ethiopia. Yields are far poorer in the south than in the north. Almost no export markets. This is an area where soil moisture was deemed to be too low to permit more than one crop a year. So you basically have your one crop centered around the rains, and when the rains are gone, you harvest your crop, and that's it. So teff, staple, is grown in this area, and almost nothing else. Unsurprisingly, the yields even for teff are far below what they are in northern Ethiopia. What to do? Well, it turns out that it's possible to retain some of the rains in the soil. And if you can, then it's possible to grow a second crop. And if you can, is the soil going to be exhausted? Well, maybe not. Maybe if you grow a crop that you can fix nitrogen so that you don't have to buy fertilizer for your second crop, such that your next year's staple crop is in better shape. So that's what has been done here, is basically soil management plus breeding plus introduction of rhizobia, a bacteria, nitrogen-fixing bacteria, alongside, for the first time in this area, chickpeas and green beans, legumes, to improve nutrition of households and to market any surplus. You'll be interested to know that PepsiCo is doing this in northern Ethiopia for export to the Middle East. And they now have a $10 million program in growing chickpeas in northern Ethiopia for export, not for national consumption. So one of the things I've been pushing the researchers to do in southern Ethiopia, where yields are about 80 to 85% of what they are in northern Ethiopia, is why not think about expanding your own marketing to do some of this yourself. As you meet nutritional needs of children and mothers, why not think about growing your markets as well? You're not that much worse than the high-yielding areas that international agribusiness is exploiting. And in fact, you're growing your own markets. Why not do that? So, clearly, there's been a fairly dramatic change. I'm going to get myself oriented here since I can't see what you see. So the palm with the seeds in it shows fairly explicitly the new varietals that have been introduced against the old varietals. Which do you think is the new varietal? So just out of curiosity, does anyone know where the center of the rhizobia industry is worldwide? Any guesses? Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan. Do you know when that industry began? Is it like 250 years old? Is it 1,000 years old imported from Europe? It's about 80 years old. Started in the 1930s from almost nothing. Saskatchewan is now the leading exporter of pulses to South Asia. To South Asia, that eats more lentils than any place on earth, imports Saskatchewan lentils. 10 years ago, Saskatchewan exported no lentils to India, zero. They are now the number one exporter of lentils to South Asia. So this is an industry, this rhizobia industry, that can grow extraordinarily fast. And we have examples in our dry western provinces that are in many remarks similar to this dry area of southern Ethiopia. Cold, dry, desperately in need of this kind of work. So this is extremely promising. Finally, let me point you to an example in Nigeria around growing and marketing forgotten indigenous vegetables. And, well, I can show you some of them. I can't show you them all. So the largest bar on this histogram is, I got to look it up myself, fluted pumpkin, ugu. Perhaps you know these better than I. The next one, igbaba, is eggplant. The third one is the leafy parts of the amaranth, not the seeds, which are like a grain, but the leafy part of the amaranth is used as a vegetable. The fourth one is celery. The fifth one is scarlet eggplant. And the last on almost the smallest bar is African nightshade. Not the witchcraft nightshade, but it's a vegetable. Take my word for it. So consumer demand for these underutilized indigenous vegetables has grown remarkably with the growth of urban food markets and the diet diversification that comes with these growing incomes in urban areas. And one of the things they're looking for is the recipes and plants that they used to have from their grandmother that they can't get in the city anymore because basically no one grows these crops anymore. And so there's been absolutely fantastic market growth in a very short period of time. Incomes have more than doubled of these vegetable-growing women. And the women themselves have now organized 27 different cooperatives just in this small project area to increase their ability to market and control midstream and downstream vegetable growth. So these are some of the small and medium entrepreneurs who are extremely dynamic. There are some problems with this first generation of piloting of innovations. Chandra may have his ideas about what some of the problems are, but in my view, there's quite a lot of problems that you might call coordination problems. So even if this research is usefully piloting these bundles of innovations, improving productivity, refining successful pilots, we still don't understand, as I said earlier, whether and how this kind of innovation might reach larger scale. And figuring this out clearly is going to increase the value of any investments made, either in research on how to do this better, or governmental or private sector investments. Clearly, there are a number of elements that need to be involved in sorting out these coordination problems. Some are infrastructural. So if you don't have good feeder roads, you can't really use the main roads. They're very difficult to use. But certainly to transport any volume of material, if you don't have easy access to a feeder road to get onto a main road, you might as well forget it. Equally, if you can't recognize a premium for your efforts, why would you bother? There's no point in doing it. So anything that can help improve midstream and downstream handling, marketing, logistics, processing will allow you to gain more from your investments in improving productivity. Partnering. The women have already recognized in Nigeria with their vegetables that they need cooperatives to help them work together and at more scale because they need to negotiate with truck drivers, because they need to negotiate with wholesale market operators, because they need to start branding their vegetables, because they need to start processing their vegetables into particular products with brand names on them such that they can capture more of the value added downstream. Smart partners who won't take advantage of you at scale. Not straightforward. They also need to figure out how to focus more explicitly on the business case. What is the business model for taking this work forward? So what are my takeaways? I'm almost done, I promise. First, food security debates have and were in part as guilty as the next at the International Development Research Center, have focused too much on the low levels of agricultural productivity on the farm, without focusing equally on the midstream and downstream post-harvest logistics, handling, processing, marketing, and distribution problems. Because there's at least, as I hope I've persuaded you, at least as much potential for transformative change there as there is obviously in terms of on-the-field productivity change. Unfortunately, that's rarely heard in most debates around food security. Clearly, and I didn't speak much about this, coordination is a growing problem. The more dynamic these kinds of food chains are, the more small and medium entrepreneurs get involved in these, the more coordination issues come to the fore, how to solve these problems. Clearly, governments, policymakers, need to think about what can we learn from these dynamic rural to urban food chains to areas that are not linked into these food chains. To those farmers who are remote to these growth engines in urban markets, what can we do about them? Clearly, also, there needs to be catalytic investments by government in infrastructure. And it's here that you see the most striking differences, both across sub-Saharan Africa and between sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, because Asia has made those infrastructural investments. And so there's a huge value added from these kinds of transformations in markets in Asia because the infrastructure permits them to grow extremely rapidly. So even in South Asia, with all of its infrastructure problems, the modern food sector can grow 45% a year every year for a decade. That's not yet happened in Africa. So what about the role of research to come finally back to us, IDRC? How can research help? You're at a university. Universities do research. How can universities help? In our view, in my view, I won't speak for Renaud. He'll speak tomorrow. He'll tell you how wrong I was. We need to have partnerships that focus on both cutting-edge technologies that combine the best of field and food science with downstream solid business analysis and economics, and perhaps even, God forbid I ever should say this, sociology. We need smart partners. And they're not just private sector partners. In many cases, they're going to be civil society actors. In other cases, they may be public actors, particularly if we're talking about nutrition education. This is not something that either civil society or the private sector is going to do very well. We must build institutions to do this work better in these countries themselves, not just in the McGills and Saskatchewans of the world, and not just in public institutions, potentially also in making private institutions like commodity exchanges work better. Donors need to collaborate better with the research community, because it's the research community that can help address some of these key coordination challenges. It's not enough just to say, we've got a wonderful black box, let's just quadruple it. We know that won't work. Even Bill Gates knows that won't work. So finally, we need research that's demand-driven, results-oriented, produces quick wins on the ground, and grounded solutions, moves from islands of success to scale, attracts and increases the role of the private sector, mobilizes young people and policymakers right from the start, and creates lasting impacts, demonstrating the value of research. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. McGurk, for this very interesting and stimulating lecture. The floor is now open for questions for Dr. McGurk. We have two microphones on the floor. I would like to ask you to identify yourself and ask your question.
Hello, my name's Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist. Okay, let's be honest. Usually when I'm kind of thinking about global food security or agriculture, full stop, here's a list of things which will probably come up. Land grabbing, such as in Tanzania or Cambodia, GMOs and the power relationship, biodiversity loss, topsoil loss, nitrogen runoff causing eutrophication in the oceans, the fact that it's about 3 calories of energy input for every calorie of energy output that food actually gives us, and with that you have the energy food water nexus or trilemma. So you can imagine, Stephen, how unhappy I am to get this very upbeat kind of like sort of scenario from you. And actually, really, I'm very pleased. But I just really want to know that if we're thinking about global food security, we're usually in the idea of kind of crisis or opportunity, and you're really presenting the opportunity. But where still are the levels of crisis that we've really got to keep an eye out for in order to actually make this more of a success story?
Do you want to take a couple at a time? And then
yes, we can do that. Are there any other questions for now? Dr. Quiroga?
My name is Eduardo Quiroga. I'm a consultant currently working in Southern Africa. Now, one of the issues we found on the ground is land tenure. For example, we run into farmers who are not willing to invest on improving the land because they don't know what's going to happen next year. And this happens under many forms in different countries. And I'd like to know if that issue was somewhat resolved, or how it was resolved in Ethiopia, and to what extent that was a driver of the wonderful news that you shared with us about Ethiopia.
Would you like to take
one more? Hi, my name is Marion. I'm a student in international development at McGill. Professor, you talk about the role of government and of research in investment in Africa. You mentioned a bit the role of companies. I'd like to know if your view of companies in this field in Africa is a positive one or a negative one, and what you think their role is. Thank you.
Okay.
Shall I just dive
in? Yes, please. Thank you.
We have been doing some work on large-scale land acquisition, land grabbing, and in 8 countries across Africa. Our research has focused on the UN Charter of Rights and the guidelines it provides for communities in the face of large-scale land acquisitions to ensure that these land acquisitions actually follow through on the charter that's agreed by virtually all of the 8 countries where we're supporting this research. I have to say the research is just in mid-stages. It's led by IPAR in Senegal, Institut de Policy Agricole Recherche. I don't have the name quite right. Sorry, I've only ever called them IPAR. With a consortia of local partners in each of the countries concerned. Canada has invested particularly in large-scale land acquisition in Senegal. So this research will both look at the Canadian investments in large-scale land acquisition in Senegal, but also beyond Senegal to try to get a slightly more comparative picture of this. At this point, preliminary findings do not appear to indicate the kind of land alienation that we saw so commonly in places like Cambodia, outside of Dili, in many parts of Burma. There do not yet appear the sorts of excesses. This is hardly a representative sample, Felix, and the research is ongoing. The research will be in the public domain, so I do encourage you, look at the IPAR site. They've been putting this material up on a regular basis. They convened a meeting with the World Bank on this earlier this spring, so there's quite a bit of sort of a first take on some of these issues in the 8 countries already there online. In terms of the broader, how do I see the mix of opportunities? As I said when I began, I am a student of sub-Saharan Africa, not a scholar. I'm not even a practitioner. I'm fortunate that I have a very, very strong team, one of whom is here today, Renaud Deplain, that I get to work with, and they get to teach me a lot. They are not suggesting the gloom and doom. In fact, when I pushed one of my colleagues, Pascal Sanginga, based in our Nairobi office, on this very low levels of agricultural productivity over a very long period of time, he immediately flipped back to me the second chart that I showed you, showing that starting in 2006, there have been significant increases. I mentioned most of the stories, and that's all they are yet, around small and medium enterprises in food supply chains as coming from the Kofi Annan Foundation. In fact, at the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa meetings in end of August, beginning of September this year, Kofi Annan, in fact, made public statements along these lines about this very dramatic transformation in food supply chains. So I take no particular credit for any insight there. How real is it? I think it's too early to say. And in Africa, I'm coming to learn that one sees evidence of virtually everything you care to look for. As you could see from the very contradictory picture on Global Hunger Index, on questions around very little in the way of irrigation, the picture looks really bad. And it's not difficult to find lots of anecdotal evidence of just how bad that picture is. On the other hand, we're increasingly seeing anecdotal evidence, a very positive growth, very dynamic transformations, again, largely driven by urban food markets. What's the balance? I'm going to say it's positive, but what do I know? Land tenure issues, Southern Africa. Immediately after I left the AGRA meetings in Addis, I went to South Africa for a range of other meetings, and Eduardo there had the good fortune to meet with a number of senior planners in the ag ministry in the South African government. And they were, in fact, more depressed than you were in your question about the difficulties of land tenure in Southern Africa, not just South Africa, but Southern Africa more generally, and what a depressing effect this is having, not just on agricultural productivity, where, again, anecdotally, all sorts of farmland is not being profitably used, largely because of these land tenure issues. But more problematically, it's slowing down the entire economy in South Africa. And it's a real problem. In Africa, Southern Africa has the weakest economic growth, not the strongest, the weakest. And it's the most problematic. And land tenure is central to these issues. So I take your point. In Ethiopia, much of the land tenure issues have come to a head around the big dams, the Renaissance Dam, particularly in northern Ethiopia. And that's a very complex set of issues involving multiple countries on the Nile. And I don't think it's completely relevant to the question you posed about Southern Africa and the importance of land tenure. It's not a problem. It's a big problem, but it's a problem of a different order, I would suggest. Mary, government's role, view of corporates. I guess I'm like anybody. I think governments should do a better job, including the Canadian government that I'm a member of. I typically scold governments virtually everywhere I go. I'm terrible that way. And you should hear me scolding Renault. Just kidding. In terms of my view of corporates, well, frankly, in this world, corporates are incredibly important, and we all live and work with corporates. We have corporates on our IDRC board. Corporates donate money to this conference, donated money, I'm sure, to the building of this residence hall. Maybe not. Who knows? You know, universities are so rich. Just kidding, Hugo. Yeah. Just kidding. No, I don't have a view of corporates. It depends on the corporates. This morning I had the delight to have breakfast with Satoshi Omura, who's the winner this year of the Gairdner Prize for Global Health for his work on curing river blindness. And he reminded me in our breakfast that he invented ivermectin, this miracle drug, which basically attacks the progeny of worms that come into the body and prevent the baby worms from climbing, the larva from climbing into your eyes, which cause river blindness, by a trowel of dirt in a golf course. That's where he found the natural compound that he then transformed into ivermectin. Now, he couldn't do that on his own. 1973 in Japan, his lab was tiny and poor. And so he went to his mentor and said, give me a list of the big American pharmaceutical companies because there's no company in Japan that can do this. And Merck stepped up. And basically, if you look on Wikipedia, which I did yesterday, you will see that Merck claims all the credit for the invention of ivermectin. The inventor of ivermectin was an institute within Merck, actually. It was Satoshi Omura, who was basically bought lock, stock, and barrel by Merck. Now, Merck then donated their entire supply of ivermectin forever to solve river blindness. Over 300 million people have been vaccinated for river blindness for nothing, for free from Merck. So companies, especially large ones, are big bundles of complex things and, you know, unsurprisingly, given how big they are, how many places they work, how many things they do. So it's not possible to take a view.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Last call for any questions, Dr. Professor Raghavan?
Vijaya Raghavan from Bioresource Engineering. You were comparison between Asian development versus South African, sub-Saharan situation was quite catchy from my point of view. You said the rate of growth was quite large in Asia, although there is a lot more that needs to be done from the global perspective. Do you think the policy mechanisms involved in the Asian countries in comparison to what's happening in sub-Saharan country, are they comparable to see that kind of a growth in the future? Because oftentimes it's the policy which limits progress.
I'm going to take a couple.
Since Dr. Lombo?
Je vais parler français puisque je ne comprends que français. Alors, je voudrais vraiment vous dire merci pour ce que vous avez dit, parce que pas mal de choses sont comme vous l'avez décrites. Si on regarde l'agriculture comme un business, on peut se poser deux questions. Nous avons une agriculture dominée par l'agriculture familiale. En tout cas, dans la plupart des pays africains, c'est l'agriculture familiale qui nourrit la population. Mais les agriculteurs n'arrivent pas à vivre de leur agriculture. Donc, tout à fait d'accord pour qu'ils deviennent des entrepreneurs, parce que c'est leur affaire, ils doivent vivre de leur affaire. Mais vous avez de l'autre côté un gros problème qui se pose, c'est que si nous tenons compte de la dynamique de la population, si nous tenons compte du fait que de plus en plus c'est l'individualisme, cette agriculture, est-ce que vous pensez que cette agriculture familiale a un avenir? Donc ça, c'est une première préoccupation. Ensuite, je voudrais être d'accord avec vous pour parler du rôle de la recherche. Je pense que c'est important qu'on voit la recherche comme quelque chose qui peut aider à résoudre les problèmes. Mais encore faut-il que nous changions de modèle. Encore faut-il que nous acceptions que nous devrions travailler sur les préoccupations et les besoins de population. Et sur ça, je suis tout à fait d'accord avec vous, parce que le privé a son rôle à jouer. C'est pourquoi nous, en Afrique de l'Ouest, nous parlons de plateforme d'innovation, où nous amenons les producteurs, les décideurs politiques, pour ce que vous avez dit, les infrastructures, mais de même que les commerçants, etc. Et donc, je voudrais partager avec vous et dire qu'effectivement, ça, c'est quelque chose d'important. Merci beaucoup.
Merci. I think we're going to take one last question. We still have.
Okay, thanks. I'm Kristen Lowe at Natural Resource Sciences. My question, I think, builds on the first one. It's also about policy. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk policy differentiation is critical, and I was just wondering if you could speak more to that. You know, I think the core challenges you've pointed to around collaboration, around how to facilitate kind of innovations and knowledge sharing are really public policy challenges. So what sort of differentiation do we need, and where should that policy change in support of the opportunities you see in terms of food security come from?
Amazing questions. I'm not sure I can answer any of them to the satisfaction of the proponents. Asia versus sub-Saharan Africa. I wouldn't be too confident about how positive the policy environment in Asia has been. When you look at changes in these food supply chains, and let's take India as a for example, one of the largest powers of growth in the food modern food sector in India were decisions as to whether to allow Indian supermarket chains to operate in different cities in India, not international, not Metro or Loblaws, but Indian supermarket chains to operate in more Indian cities. And in waiting for these decisions to actually come through, the Indian corporates invested enormously in hedging their bets around whichever way the policy decision was going to go. So they prepared the way to annex other firms if they thought they were going to get approval and they could go in a very big way. Or if they thought they weren't going to get the policy decision, then they basically got themselves out of significant segments of the supermarket markets and into a whole range of other types of distribution and retail systems. Policy could have been a lot clearer about what the public policy goal was in this, so as to not waste all of these resources chasing chimera. In economics terms, we call that a dead weight loss for society. So yes, Asian governments did better so far because they invested, I think, in critical catalytic infrastructure. India and the rest of South Asia lags very much the rest of Asia in this regard. And in fact, in this regard, South Asia looks just like sub-Saharan Africa, almost no difference at all. And unsurprisingly, on virtually every measure of poverty, literacy, health, and food security, South Asia looks on a par or worse than sub-Saharan Africa. In terms of domination by family farming, and what are the implications of a family farming-dominated world? Well, there are many places in the world where modern food businesses have been built up on the foundations of family farming. In fact, outside of North America and parts of Northern Europe, the vast majority of the world's agriculture is built on family farming. If you look at Latin America, you look at Asia, it's not large-scale commercial farming in the main. There are exceptions. Thailand in Asia is a very big exception. Large-scale commercial farming in Thailand. There's a few exceptions, but the rule is family farming, not commercial farming. Has that impeded the inclusion of these large numbers of family farms in these modern food systems? The evidence clearly demonstrates it's mixed the picture. In Latin America, yes, it did. And it's led to very real exclusion of family farms from larger marketplaces in Latin America. In fact, this was a huge debate in Latin America through the 1980s and 1990s. In Asia, it's not. It's been a very different pattern of development in Asia. And family farming is still completely integrated into marketplaces. They're not excluded. We supported a generation of studies under the moniker of Regoverning Markets. What a terrible name. Who'd ever call a project Regoverning Markets? No one knows what governance is anyway. And then you're going to govern markets? No, you're going to re-govern markets. God knows. Who came up with that? Anyway, it's a 15-donor-supported study over a decade that involved about 60 countries around the world answering one question. Are smallholder farmers excluded from modern food systems? And the answers I just provided are laid out very well in that work. So for China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam in Asia, they were not excluded. So small family farms were every bit as much involved in these value chains targeting big urban markets as were commercial farms. Now, the key question in Asia has been around standard setting, because when you are involved in a value chain, you get signals from the final consumers to up the standards of the product. And those signals wind their way up the value chain back to the producers. And the question is, can small farmers improve their standards enough to remain involved in these things? Governments can help. So in China, for example, the government invested in cheapening the price of environmentally destructive plastics so that you could spread small hothouse technologies on a very small scale throughout the country so that more farmers could grow things like tomatoes out of season and market those tomatoes in big urban markets. This had a dramatic impact on poverty reduction, also led to, as anyone knows who's been to rural China, lots and lots of environmental refuse all over the place. In terms of the future of family farming, it's an empirical question. It's a combination of how these value chains work with markets, how governments work with these value chains, how governments are involved in attempts to upgrade technology. If you have a good agricultural extension system, you can do these things. If in many countries in West Africa you have no agricultural extension system left, this is a problem for a government, as you know better than I, running one of them. In terms of the role of research, I thank you very much for your questions and your vote of confidence. Good to hear we may be on the right track, maybe. Christine, if I caught your name correctly, I'm looking around. There you are. I didn't quite catch your question. I think you were talking about how to differentiate policy across more remote or more isolated, poor strata or poor geographic regions. This is never easy. A number of governments have tried area-based poverty programs. A number of governments have tried universal cash transfer type of programs. A number of governments have tried building on success, as I mentioned during the presentation, actually looking at what works in the dynamic areas and then seeing if you can't pump prime, if you permit, outside of those dynamic areas. So, for example, in the part of my career when I was an investment banker in China, what we tried to do in some of the poorest areas was actually pump prime to get people from poorer areas more involved in urban areas beyond their region so that they could start chains of information and flow of people and resources across these areas so that these areas, and we did that by giving free bus tickets. You know, one has to be creative. One of my colleagues in the investment banking business went around cities in Asia offering mayors a free fleet of buses, public buses. In return, he captured the money by saying, you must give me all the advertising on the buses. I get to put any advertising up on the buses, and I get to recoup money off of those advertising. But I'll give you a fleet of buses for free. So I think there are things one can do if you're creative in this area, but it's a very tough issue to address. And I don't think anyone has really done it well. Even today in China, with the most highly regarded record on poverty reduction, there are still very large pockets of poor people in the southwest, in the northwest, and increasingly in urban areas of China. I was visiting 18 months ago some of my old colleagues. I sit on the board of an Academy of Sciences rural research institute in China. And I went to see them in their new, very swank quarters overlooking the Olympic Village and the Bird's Nest Stadium. And it was a big highway in between where I got off the cab and their new buildings. And so I thought, oh, I'll just go under the highway because I know all these buildings connect underneath the highway. So I'll just go underneath there. The very, you know, high-rise, new building, first world Beijing, right? And so I go down into the corridors, and it's like the land of the mice people. There's, you know, every little corner, there's some guy's got staked out his bedroll down there. And this is the migrant workforce of the city of Beijing, you know, living in these nooks and crannies buried beneath the concrete. Scary stuff. So very, very difficult to address these issues. I don't think there's easy answers. I'm sorry I can't give you a more straightforward answer.
Thank you very much for your responses to the questions, your reflections, and your thoughts. A lot of food for thought. I want to remind us all that Dr. McGurk's presentation this session will be uploaded in the webpage of the Institute for Global Food Security, where you can access this presentation and the others in the conference later on, a couple of weeks after we wrap up this year's conference. Thank you very much to all of you. Join me in thanking once again Dr. McGurk for his lecture. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me back.